Yes, so exploring our life with full attention, which has been based around Maitreya Bandhu's very excellent book. And this week we're going to be looking at awareness of others, awareness of other people. So why especially be aware of other people? Well, Buddhism, like other religions, says that our suffering comes from our egocentric view of life. We become caught in a way of seeing the world that has at its center an ego or egoic belief, a belief that I am the center of things and the world is external to me. And we see the world in terms of me in here and you out there. But the Buddha's vision saw this was not the case. His awakened vision saw this was not the case. That there is no me in here separate from a you out there. In fact, there isn't really an in here and an out there at all. But the belief that there is causes us to suffer in all sorts of ways. And this belief in an egoic me is accompanied by the idea that there is something solid and ultimate that resides here. And from this belief, we get the idea that the world and experience can be split up in a definitive kind of way into me and not me. And once we have this idea, of course, we start to do things for this me and from this me. And we start to believe that, we do believe in an external world which is solid and separate from me. And we start to think in terms of things, my things, your things, my having things, you're having things, my not having things, you're having things. And from this, we can see that there is an outside of ourself and then a wish to push away things that are not considered ourselves and to pull things towards us that we want to be, as it were, a part of ourselves. And we try to pull the world into us. And these two responses of craving and aversion were part of what the Buddha's vision was about how we are and how we respond to life from this wrong view about the nature of things. And these views of life become based on our egoic view of an egoic center to life. Become quite sophisticated and abstracted. So what is me and what is not me? For instance, anybody who doesn't hold the same mental map of the world as me is not me. Anyone who does hold the same mental map of the world or by association is me. So we can include those people within our circumference who we consider to share the same mental map of the world and reject those who don't. And I'm sure you can fill in the blanks as to what ensues from what is basically a belief. And a wrong belief is what the Buddha was saying. So when we start to see through this belief, or at least when we start to not act out of a belief in an ultimate separate me, we can experience an expansiveness of ourselves, an expansiveness of our experience, and a kind of dissolving of this imaginary boundary. And this dissolving is what we call love. Love in the sense of recognition and identification with the being of another person. This love is empathic, well-wishing, compassionate, and increasingly imperturbable. By becoming aware of another in a non-objectifying way, i.e. by not seeing the person in terms of our own needs and desires, we're starting to dissolve this fundamental view or belief in the egoic self that causes us so much suffering. So love, you could say, is the awareness of another person. We cannot really love another without being aware of them, and we can't really be aware of them, not really aware of them, without loving them. So mindfulness of others takes us out of our deluded belief in separateness, which we feel as love. An increasing intimacy with the other. I don't mean sexual or physical intimacy, that's usually something else, but an emotional intimacy, a sense of connection with the other. And there are practical things we can do as practicing the Dharma, wherever we're at with that, particularly in our own lives. We can do to realize our awareness of other people and to engender this love. And the Metta Bhavana practice, which we teach at the center, is essentially a development of the awareness of others. So the Metta Bhavana, you could say, is mindfulness in the sphere of other people. And in the Metta Bhavana, of course, we bring to mind five lots of people, ourselves, a good friend, neutral person, person we're having difficulty with, and then all beings, all living beings. And we're in that practice of the Metta Bhavana, we're moving out from a feeling that we're moving out. It's like a direction out from ourselves towards others. And it's increasingly challenging as we go through the stages. A good friend, it's easier to feel that love and connection with. A neutral person, it's more difficult. Somebody we're having difficulty with, or an enemy, it can become very difficult to feel that love and connection with. So each stage is progressively more difficult and asks more of us in that practice. Although interestingly, the first stage is often the most problematic for us. We live in a culture where self-esteem issues seem to be a part of what makes us up. And we can find it very difficult to feel good about ourselves or to love ourselves. In fact, often within our culture, I think the idea of loving ourselves is usually in itself problematic. It's often seen as self-indulgent or even narcissistic. It seems to be fine to help other people, to love other people, but not so much ourselves. So what does it mean to love oneself? So I said earlier to really know another person is to love them. And I would suggest that we often don't relate to ourselves as a person. And this is why the first stage of the Metta Bhavana can be difficult. We are often critical and judgmental with ourselves, often in a way that we would never be with others. And this is a reflection of not seeing ourselves as a person, or not fully seeing ourselves as a person. So we can hold up standards for ourselves that are very few human beings could possibly meet. And this is not seeing ourselves as a person. We're often willing to forgive others, but not often willing to forgive ourselves. And this is not relating to ourselves as a human being. So taking an example of a good friend. They're a good friend because we do see them as a person. We do see them as a human being. We know that they're not perfect, and we allow for their foibles and their blind spots. And we forgive them their transgressions, or what we believe to be their transgressions. And we believe in them as a person. We don't expect them to be perfect. We try not to judge them because we know that they are basically good and that they are trying to come to terms with life and its issues and that they make mistakes. So we are a human being like our friend. We are a human being like our friend. So let us be good friends to ourselves. Let us treat ourselves like our good friends treat us. If we do this, I'm sure that love will flourish in us. So there is something in love that is mindful, that is aware. It's the awareness of ourselves and others as human beings, with all that that entails. And we're not aware of ourselves and others as perfect. We're aware of ourselves as we are. And we are aware of others as they are. And this is what we love and are aware of. Love and awareness relate to what is, not to our expectations and ideas about what should be, but to what actually is. The person in front of us, whoever that is. So today we're going to do an exercise. Well, at least I'm going to invite you to participate in an exercise. But rather than becoming aware of ourselves, as might have just been suggested by what I'm talking about, I'm going to talk about a suggestion from Maitreya Bandhu's book, which we've been following, which is relates to being aware of our parents. So I was very struck by this in his book about some of the advice he had to relate to our parents. And this can be whether they're alive or dead. In my case, both of my parents are deceased, and yet, I still have a relationship with them, interestingly. And of course, our relationship with our parents is potentially quite a difficult one. And one of the things about our parents is certainly that's been my experience, is that they can be very hard to relate to as people, because we nearly always see them through the filter of our own ideas and expectations, and all sorts of other filters we have. It's quite difficult to see them as people. And, like it or not, there's probably quite a lot of our parents in us. So to relate to our parents more objectively, to see them more as human beings, is also, I think, to accept aspects of ourselves that perhaps we don't, that we don't like, and that we don't see objectively, and often that we don't forgive as well. So I'm just going to give a couple of examples from my own experience with my parents, hopefully to make the point. So I remember the first time I recall seeing my mother objectively. I was probably about 35 years old at the time. So it took me quite a long time to get to that point where I could start to see my mother in any way objectively. So I decided, I can't remember why now, but my parents, I think, offered it actually, because they were going on holiday to see my aunt and uncle in Canada. My aunt and uncle are still alive and they still live in Canada. And I hadn't seen them for a while. So I said, yes, I'll come along with them. So we went, I think it was over Christmas actually. And some point in that trip, we were going along in my uncle's car and we'd gone down a kind of a track, you know, and it was a bit bumpy and the road was bumpy. And my mum was somebody who I'd struggled with, let's say. I did have a difficult time, I think, you know, growing up with my mum. And she, one of the things that she was quite an anxious person, and it was very hard for her to kind of contain her anxiety. In this case, we were going down this bumpy road and we hit a bump and she went, "Oh, what's that?" classic reaction from my mum. And when she used to do that, I used to kind of often get a little bit annoyed. I don't quite know why. I mean, we get annoyed with our parents for all sorts of reasons. Perhaps I thought it was like an overreaction. And we are quite identified with our parents, so, you know, whatever. But on that moment, I don't know where I was. Maybe I was just staring out the window at the countryside. And I just turned towards my mother and I suddenly saw her as this frightened and anxious old lady. I mean, I already knew that she was a frightened and anxious old lady, but it just like it hit me, you know, that, you know, wasn't the entirety of my mother, of course, but, you know, it was an aspect of my mother that she was actually like that. And, you know, what must it be like to be that anxious? And it opened up this feeling of great empathy for my mum. And I almost welled up in tears. I just felt very sorry for her and very compassionate for her, at least that aspect of her, you know, that was frightened and anxious a lot of the time. And strangely, I mean, after that experience, I could never quite go back to, there was always some objectivity in my experience of her. It's like it sort of cut some bond in our relationship, maybe the neurotic part of it, or the part where I saw myself as her son. And I started from that moment to see her more and more as a human being. And it wasn't that she couldn't, you know, still push my buttons. she was an expert in it, actually. But I could never quite sort of react in quite the same way, because I felt this love and empathy for her as a human being, not just as my mother. So the second example is my parents invited me, I might have been a similar age, maybe a bit younger actually, they'd invited me back for a weekend and it was their anniversary, one of their, kind of wedding anniversaries, maybe sort of 30-year wedding anniversary. And I'd gone back and they'd had a party for their friends. And I think they've kind of forgotten that I was there at the party. And they were opening presents from their friends. And they just went into their... how they were naturally with their friends. And they started this sort of joking repartee between themselves that was actually quite hilarious. And All the friends were laughing and really kind of, just enjoying them as people. And I thought, oh my God, I've never seen that side of my parents. I just didn't know that side of their parents. And it struck me that there were probably whole sides to my parents that I didn't really know. And it was really lovely. It was really lovely to experience something outside of my box of what my parents were. Quite a still at that point, quite a reactive little box of what my parents were, and to see them kind of in their own element, as it were, and enjoying the company of their own friends and being people, being ordinary people. Yeah. So those are my two examples. So, like I said, I thought I'd invite us to do a bit of an exercise. Well, in fact, really a kind of metta-bhavana meditation. Well, it is a metta-bhavana meditation, where we're first going to, just ground ourselves in meditation. Think about a good friend, make contact with that good friend in a particular way. And then we're going to introduce one of our parents into the metta-bhavana meditation. Normally, when you're taught the metta-bhavana, or often when we teach it, we recommend that you don't use a parent within the metta-bhavana meditation, because we can get into the, we can get into this parental kind of love, or we can get into a parental relationship to the person, which can be different from, well, metta, which is a more universalized and unconditional kind of loving. But in this instance, we're going to have a go at doing this. So this could be problematic. So be sensitive with yourselves, because I know we don't always have a good relationship with our parents. In fact, some of us might not even be in contact with them for whatever reason. Some of us, our parents may be deceased, so feelings of grief may come up as we focus in this way. So just be sensitive. If you feel yourself, getting particularly overcome by any particularly strong emotions, simply come back to the body, the experience of the body. It's always the safe refuge in meditation if anything sort of difficult starts to arise. So with that caveat, lost the sheet. So yeah, so just a little bit, just add a little bit more. Yeah. So, I mean, our relationship with our parents is often complex. So, in some ways, they may appear in all the stages, as it were, or they may fit into all the stages of a metta-bhavana. So there may be some dimension of our parents that is like friendship. There may be some dimension of our parents which is like the neutral person. In fact, some of us, like I said, may not know our parents very well, or they're just aspects of our parents that we just don't know, like I was suggesting in those examples. And then, of course, there may be aspects of our parents that are difficult. So that's kind of how we're going to do the meditation in terms of those stages, and approach our parents with those different stages. And remembering that what we're trying to do is become more aware of them as human beings. So if we want to get into some sort of meditation posture, just to get comfortable. Establishing or making sure we have a good posture for meditation. So a good grounding with the earth. The earth is great support in meditation. In fact, it's a continual support through our lives. The Buddha, at the time of his awakening, is sometimes seen in statues. He's touching the earth in what is called the earth touching mudra. The earth bearing witness to him. And that grounding of experience, grounding of ourselves, our bodies are born from elements of the earth. So feeling that contact with the ground, with the cushions, feeling the support of the earth. So our attention is usually located somewhere within the body. So becoming sensitive and aware of where our attention resides at the moment. Most of the time, the locus of our attention is with the thinking mind. So it feels to be somewhere up around the head, behind the eyes. So we're going to bring that locus of attention down into the body, unhooking from the thinking mind, and coming into direct awareness of the sensations, the tactile experience of the face and the jaw. So coming into the direct sensate tactile body can feel quite different to attention when it's fixated on thinking. But attention can enter directly into the sensations of the body. So looking for those sensations in the face and jaw. It's like attention is inhabiting those parts of the body. And we're going to come down through the body to the lower abdomen. By following or picking up on the tactile sensations that we experience. So coming down from the face and the jaw into the neck and the throat, that area of the body, looking for the direct sensations. Going down into the upper chest. Picking up on sensations of movement of the rib cage. Looking for direct tactile sensation. The direct experience of it. The area around the bottom of the rib cage, where the diaphragm is. There's often a lot of sensation around here. And then coming down into the lower abdomen. So the area below the navel. And again, inhabiting the direct sensations we experience in that part of the body. Coming back to the heart center. So in the middle of the chest, below the breastplate, what can we feel in terms of sensations in this part of the body? If we don't feel much, try taking our awareness back behind the heart. Sometimes this stirs something in our experience. We might like to visualize the color red emanating from that part of the body, like a warm glow. So I'm going to call to mind a good friend. We're going to become aware of them in their fullness. And call to mind their good qualities, their strengths, their beautiful aspects, what we like about them. We're also going to call to mind that we are aspects of our friend that we maybe don't know, that are unknown to us. Or aspects that we don't see clearly. So allowing that to be there. And also relating to the aspects of our good friend that we find difficult. So there may be some particular habits, some blind spots that we think they have. Is there some part of us that expects our good friend to be perfect? Are there expectations in our way of seeing them? Is this reasonable? Are they trying to come to terms with life in a similar way to us? Do they make mistakes? Is it reasonable that they make mistakes? Is there any way that we want our good friend to be different. And does our wanting them to be different help them in any way? Calling to mind one of our parents, with the intention of seeing them in their fullness as human beings. Being aware of their strengths, their qualities, aware of things that we like about them, recognizing that there are aspects of them that we don't know, or if they're deceased that we didn't know. A life outside of us, work, their particular interests, maybe their relationship with other people, relationships that we are not a party to. And aware of their foibles, their blind spots, the difficult aspects of their personality, Do we or did we expect them to be perfect? Is this reasonable? Did they or do they want to be happy? Like we want to be happy. Are they like us, trying to come to terms with life, with the difficulties and issues it presents? And given all of our limitations, are they like us, trying to do the best they can? Do they make mistakes? Is it reasonable that they make mistakes? If we carry expectations about them, ways that we think they ought to be, that we would like them to be different, do those expectations help them in any way?